Here, inadvertently, Le Soleil has employed an exceedingly suspicious phrase. The pieces, as described, do indeed look like strips torn off, but purposely and by hand. It is one of the rarest of accidents that the pieces torn off from any garment, such as is now in question, by the agency of a thorn. From the very nature of such fabrics, a thorn or nail becoming tangled in them tears them rectangularly, divides them into two longitudinal rents, at right angles with each other, and meeting at an apex where the thorn enters. But it is scarcely possible to conceive the piece torn off. I never so knew it, nor did you. To tear a piece off from such fabric, two distinct forces in different directions will be in almost every case required. If there be two edges to the fabric, if, for example, it be a pocket handkerchief, and it is desired to tear from it a slip, then and then only will the one force serve the purpose. But in the present case, the question is of a dress, presenting but one edge. To tear a piece from the interior where no edge is presented could only be effected by a miracle through the agency of thorns, and no one thorn could accomplish it. But even where an edge is presented, two thorns will be necessary, operating the one in two distinct directions and the other in one, and this in the supposition that the edge is unhemmed. If hemmed, the matter is nearly out of the question. We thus see the numerous and great obstacles in the way of pieces being torn off through the simple agency of thorns. Yet we are required to believe not only that one piece, but that many have been so torn. And one part, too, was the hem of the frock. Another piece was part of the skirt, not the hem. That is to say, was torn completely out through the agency of thorns from the unedged interior of the dress. These, I say, are things which one may be well pardoned for disbelieving. Yet, taken collectively, they form perhaps less of a reasonable ground for suspicion than the one startling circumstance of the articles having been left in this thicket at all by any murderers who had enough precaution to think of removing the corpse. You will not have apprehended me rightly, however, if you suppose it my design to deny this thicket as the scene of the outrage. There might have been a wrong here, or more possibly, an accident at Madame Duloc's. But in fact, this is a point of minor importance. We are not engaged in an attempt to discover the scene, but to produce the perpetrators of the murder. What I have adduced, notwithstanding the minuteness with which I have adduced it, has been with the view first to show the folly of the positive and headlong assertions of Le Soleil, but secondly and chiefly to bring you, by the most natural route, to a further contemplation of the doubt whether this assassination has or has not been the work of a gang. We will resume this question by mere allusion to the revolting details of the surgeon examined at the inquest. It is only necessary to say that his published inferences in regard to the number of the ruffians have been properly ridiculed as unjust and totally baseless by all the reputable anatomists of Paris. Not that the matter might not have been as inferred, but that there was no ground for the inference. Was there not much for another? Let us reflect now upon the traces of a struggle, and let me ask what these traces have been supposed to demonstrate. A gang. But do they not rather demonstrate the absence of a gang? What struggle could have taken place? What struggle so violent and so enduring as to have left its traces in all directions? Between a weak and defenseless girl and a gang of ruffians imagined. The silent grasp of a few rough arms and all would have been over. The victim must have been absolutely passive at the will. You will here bear in mind that the arguments urged against the thicket as the scene are applicable in chief part only against it as the scene of an outrage committed by more than a single individual. If we imagine but one violator, we can conceive, and thus only conceive, the struggle of so violent and so obstinate a nature as to have left the traces apparent. And again, I have already mentioned the suspicion to be excited by the fact that the articles in question were suffered to remain at all in the thicket were discovered. It seems almost impossible that these evidences of guilt should have been accidentally left where found. There was sufficient presence of mind, it is supposed, to remove the corpse, and yet a more positive evidence than the corpse itself, whose features might have been quickly obliterated by decay, is allowed to lie conspicuously in the scene of the outrage. I allude to the handkerchief with the name of the deceased. If this was accident, it was not the accident of a gang. We can imagine it only the accident of an individual. Let us see. An individual has committed the murder. He is alone with the ghost of the departed. He is appalled by what lies motionless before him. The fury of his passion is over, and there is abundant room in his heart for the natural awe of the deed. His is none of that confidence which the presence of numbers inevitably inspires. He is alone with the dead. He trembles and is bewildered. Yet there is a necessity for disposing of the corpse. He bears it to the river, and leaves behind him the other evidences of his guilt, for it is difficult, if not impossible, to carry all the burthen at once, and it will be easy to return for what is left. But in his toilsome journey to the water, his fears redouble within him. The sounds of life encompass his path. A dozen times he hears, or fancies he hears, the step of an observer. Even the very lights from the city bewilder him. Yet in time, and by long and frequent pauses of deep agony, he reaches the river's brink and disposes of his ghastly charge, perhaps through the medium of a boat. But now, what treasure does the world hold? What threat of vengeance could it hold out, which would have power to urge the return of that lonely murderer over the toilsome and perilous path to the thicket and its blood-chilling recollections. He returns not. Let the consequences be what they may. He could not return if he would. His sole thought is immediate escape. He turns his back forever upon those dreadful shrubberies and flees as from the wrath to come. But how is the gang? Their number would have inspired them with confidence, if indeed confidence is ever wanting in the breast of the errant blackguard, and of errant blackguards alone as the supposed gangs ever constituted. Their number, I say, would have prevented the bewildering and unreasoning terror which I have imagined to paralyze the single man. Could we suppose an oversight in one, or two, or three? This oversight would have been remedied by a fourth. They would have left nothing behind them, for their number would have enabled them to carry all at once. There would have been no need of return. Consider now the circumstance that, in the outer garment of the corpse when found, a slip, about a foot wide, had been torn upward from the bottom hem to the waist, wound three times round the waist, and secured by a sort of hitch in the back. This was done with the obvious design of affording a handle by which to carry the body. But would any number of men have dreamed of resorting to such an expedient? To three or four, the limbs of the corpse would have afforded not only a sufficient, but the best possible hold. The device is that of a single individual. And this brings us to the fact that between the thicket and the river, the rails of the fences were found taken down, and the ground bore evident traces of some heavy burden being dragged along it. But would a number of men have put themselves to the superfluous trouble of taking down a fence for the purpose of dragging through it a corpse which they might have lifted over any fence in an instant? Would a number of men have so dragged a corpse at all as to have left evident traces of the dragging?